I just wrote an article, and it's called Land of the Lawless. Lawlessness is the norm in our country for the rich and powerful. It is the norm. And the law schools refuse to recognize that. That corporations are violating the law. And if they get caught 1% of the time, it's too much for them.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on Land of the Lawless. Politicians and pundits love to go on and on about the rule of law. The concept that no one is above the law is laudatory and central to a functioning democracy. But we can easily see the grotesque disparities in the application of law and the prosecution of those who commit crimes in the streets versus those who commit crimes in the suites. From invading and bombing countries, to suborning perjury, to witness tampering, to tax evasion, to bribery, the big boys and girls are not brought to justice. They are not held accountable for their crimes. Instead, they are rewarded with fat book contracts and lecture fees. No wonder some people are cynical. The hypocrisy is hard to miss. How can we move from being the land of the lawless to a society where the rule of law prevails? Our guest today is Ralph Nader. Few have had a more meaningful and productive career of public service than Ralph Nader. The legendary consumer advocate has waged battles with big corporations and the U.S. government. He was named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history. He was born in 1934 in Winsted, Connecticut, to Lebanese immigrant parents. He rose to fame in the 1960s when he took on General Motors and its unsafe Corvair car. Through his decades-long ceaseless efforts, Ralph Nader has helped us drive safer cars, eat healthier food, breathe better air, drink cleaner water, and work in safer environments. He spoke at Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. And now, Ralph Nader.
Thank you all for coming. There are interesting people in the audience here, and they make a lot of the points that I want to make. But just consider, 30 years ago, who would have dreamed that an independent bookstore would triumph over Borders and Barnes & Noble? Okay? That's part of exemplifying an important principle of our civic culture, which isn't emphasized enough, that our country exhibits the movement from what was implausible to what became reality. When I came to this town, it was impossible to even conceive that the tobacco industry could be held to account, not just in terms of their seducing youngsters into a lifetime of smoking and death, but in terms of smoking in public places. And when we took on the tobacco industry, first with airlines, buses, and trains, on the grounds that non-smokers have a right not to have smoke blown into their lungs and their kids' lungs, we were called communists. We were called subverters of the American dream, which is to smoke wherever they want. All kinds of names. But we were also told we were pie in the sky, that the grip on Congress is too powerful. All right, so you see what happened. Now, what happened was due to less than 1,000 people. They were public health specialists, very vibrant doctors. They were some litigators, some tort lawyers, a handful of lawmakers, children's advocates, people who were trying to deal with asthma. Never more than 1,000. And they built it up, and stuff spilled out of the internal files of the tobacco companies, got out of 60 Minutes, and people began writing more about it. And that got more smokers to be aggressive. I remember when I was at university, the students who smoked would actually come up to you and blow smoke in your face and say, "Why the hell aren't you smoking?" You walked into a classroom and they were smoking. Walked into an exam, and they were smoking. In protest once, I walked into a classroom in my pajamas. Can you imagine how it is? Now, imagine a young person today walking into a plane or a bus or a, you know, train, and someone pulls out a cigarette or a cigar. I sat next to a guy in a plane, he pulled out his cigar. The old saying that the blasphemy of today is the triumph of tomorrow. And we don't have enough of that in our minds. We have the lowest expectations of our country that I've ever seen, ever, in my study of history and contemporary life. And you can see how low the expectations are in a society full of solutions on the shelf that aren't applied on the ground by looking at the political system and the corporatist system and their incredible domination in spite of efforts to regulate them and break them up and campaign finance. They have never been more powerful and in insinuated ways that most of us couldn't have predicted with the onset of the internet and what Facebook and Google and others now are doing to, in effect, decide what millions of people read about or see. There's a recent contract that was exposed by Robert Felmuth at University of San Diego Law School between Facebook and preteens. And the preteens would sign the contract and assure Facebook that they had the permission of one parent to have the material they put on Facebook be used in, you know, sent anywhere in Facebook's discretion. Imagine that kind of contractual child molestation would never have been predicted years ago. When I was in law school, we never would have seen what has happened to our freedom of contract, completely destroyed by clicking on or signing on a dotted line, giving up our constitutional rights to go to court, trial by jury, giving the vendor unilateral modification. There's no such thing as a contract. If the airline can modify your frequent flyer stuff at will and say, as long as you're flying the airline, you've agreed, the whole manipulation of consent and the access for wrongful injury and tort law. These corporations are smashing at the fundamentals of freedom in our country. Private law of torts and private law of contracts inherited from England are the fundamental pillars of freedom in our country because we're supposed to be able to use them without asking anyone's permission, no agency or anybody. You negotiate a contract or you go to a lawyer and file against a predator corporation that sold you a hazardous pharmaceutical or a car. So this is very important to keep this in mind before we spin off into the frantic news of the day and sabotage our own expectation levels. And that happens to the most rational and well-read people. They want to know the latest. What will Mueller do? Nothing is more important than attesting to, I think, what is a truism, that the last chapter of the United States of America will not be written by the oppressors. They will be written by us. They will be written by our withdrawal, our cynicism that masquerades as insight, by our standing as bystanders. The worst script of history is written by informed bystanders who could have done something about it. And so on that score, let me just give you an example. In the front row is Joan Claybrook. Now, Joan's done a lot as head of NHTSA and auto safety, and with a few others. But in one area, without her, it would have not happened, and that is the standard for safe seat belts for children in cars, right? So Lone Ranger on that. Sine qua non. Graduate of Goucher. Went to work for Social Security Administration. Then interned under a political science fellowship with a congressman from Georgia who got interested in auto safety. Somewhere here is Bert Fohr. Where's Bert? Yes, he was with the Federal Trade Commission as an economist lawyer on antitrust, and he started with my help, the American Institute of Antitrust, at a time when it was totally collapsing intellectually, succumbing to the Chicago's monetized mind school of so-called economics. And he built a whole brain trust, advisory brain trust, and began putting out studies, reports, petitions, testimony before Congress. Without Burt, none of this would have happened. There are a lot of people who are economists and lawyers, right? Who are they working for? What are they going to look back on when they're 80? What justice bandwagon did they miss? Like corporate lawyers. Here in our midst is the greatest expert on energy in the United States of America, who is never called by the media. Because the media now interviews each other on things, you know. Judy Woodruff interviews the New York Times writer on energy. But they don't interview someone who has advised several presidents, starting before President Carter, someone who's an engineer, who's a lawyer, who ran the Tennessee Valley Authority, who ran the SMUD utility in San Francisco, who ran the water municipal utility in L.A., who advised Governor Brown, who advised Governor Cuomo, the first Governor Cuomo, who is everywhere now showing how we can convert into renewable energy, who started out as a nuclear power advocate until I convinced him otherwise. Now he is the best nuclear power opponent. His name is David Freeman. David, where are you? There he is. See? Now, and he's negotiating the close down of the last nuclear plant in California. Now, with Pacific Gas and Electric. Now, why are we so pessimistic? Why are we so withdrawn? Why are we so cynically sophisticated? Why have we given up on ourselves? This is nonsense. You have 1 million people who are enlightened and progressive. If each one is a bystander, 1 million people have zero influence. Unfortunately, we haven't developed biological systems where we can connect with one another and one contagious citizen can energize all the rest. We have to do it all by ourselves. And we're not doing it. We're losing the charity race and not focusing on the justice race. And we all know the difference between the two. Charity is important. They have soup kitchens, nice soup kitchens, here in the District of Columbia. The question is, why do we need soup kitchens? Where is the justice that prevents the need for charity? You have some of the worst poverty in the country here in the District of Columbia. I just put out a tweet. I don't tweet much, but and I do it indirectly. I still use an Underwood typewriter. And the tweet went this way. The Republican politicos are energized by money and greed. The Democrat politicos are compromised by money and greed. Guess who's winning? So this is how they keep us at bay. Don't you know how bad the Republicans are? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can write a book in 20 minutes on how bad the Republican parties are. They would totally shock Senator Robert Taft and Dwight Eisenhower and Teddy Roosevelt. They are the cruelest, most vicious party in the history of the United States. They have actually voted against issues involving saving kids' lives, giving them adequate health care. Protecting them from toxics. They have no shame whatsoever because we don't have a society that knows how to shame them. Instead, they are landsliding the Democrats instead of the Democrats landsliding the worst, most anti-worker, consumer, warmongering, Wall Street, toady, on and on and on party. A party staffed on Capitol Hill with levels of arrogance and ignorance never wedded together to that degree. These people think that there's no such thing as climate disruption. They think corporations will save the world. They think problems with water pollution, just stop polluting. Doesn't matter. They don't believe in law and order for the rich and powerful. So why aren't the Democrats landsliding them? Because their side is so frantically hypnotized by how bad the Republicans are that they give the Democrats free hand to approximate them. Trump did not erupt spontaneously. That all the things that we are appalled about Trump had precursors that erupted in their own way that we accepted. Let's start with the personal thing. His disgusting personal morals. Who was a precursor that survived disgusting personal morals and got away with it? Bill Clinton. That never was seen possible. He could ever survive those disclosures, both when in the New Hampshire primary and later on with Ms. Lewinsky. Let's take lawlessness. Right now, as we speak, Trump is droning and bombing anywhere he wants. Special forces went into 140 countries last year, maybe some with the permission of their dictators, others not. The world is our military killing field. Whatever happened to international law? Trump is lawless. He doesn't obey the Constitution. He doesn't obey federal statutes. He doesn't recognize international treaties. Guess who taught him? Prior presidents. A constitutional lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School extended the lawlessness abroad of George W. Bush. He didn't invade and blow apart Iraq, but he expanded drone warfare. He expanded assassination. He became the designated Tuesday morning homicide orderer. Imagine sitting in the White House with his advisors and they say, here's Abdu this and Muhammad that and Butrus this. And you know, they don't like America. It's the New York Times report, page one. They got a prize for it. But the idea of our president being prosecutor, judge, jury, executioner, and cover-upper precedes Donald Trump. It precedes Obama. It precedes Bush. It precedes Clinton. But they all expanded it. So now we're numb to it. We're numb to it. It doesn't even make the headlines anymore. Some would say, well, you know, that's the bitter fruits of empire. Well, let's bring it back home. Our adversaries came out of countries that we carved up with the British and French and installed dictators and backed them to the hilt diplomatically, militarily, and politically. And they happened to abuse their own people. And their own people began to wonder who's behind the abusers. And then when 9/11 occurred, we were surprised. Why are we surprised? What would we have done if the shoe was on the other foot? And instead of reacting multilaterally to bring the perpetrators to justice, we blew apart Afghanistan and then Iraq, and now it's spilled into 20 countries. So all this is basically to get us to the level where we say the Constitution puts a burden on us. It starts with we the people. It doesn't start with we the Congress. It doesn't start with we the corporation. It doesn't start with we the Pentagon. It starts with we the people. And that burden means that we pull back on our sovereign power, which we have wildly delegated to our government, which in turn has assigned it to the corporatists. And so we have now a maturing corporate state where the ties between business and government are like this. This yesterday in the Washington Post. How about this one? 90% of the people in this country are upset with airline fees. It's like you get hit with a fee for everything but breathing or going to the restroom. So what does the Congress do? They recognize that the leading complaint by people about the airlines conveyed to Congress are airline fees, except for Southwest, which doesn't have these $200 reservation fee changes and other imposed penalties, which you are, by the way, told you agreed to in the fine print contract. Well, the word last week was the section in the FAA authorization bill was going to give the Department of Transportation modest regulatory power against inappropriate fees or unreasonable fees. And the opinion was overwhelmingly for it. Well, they dropped it. They cut the section out. I sent a survey to all members of Congress listing all the freebies the airlines give, guess what? The members of Congress. Not us. They have all kinds of freebies, all kinds of privileges, all kinds of exemptions from how they treat normal passengers. And we sent one to every one of the 535 people, including our friends. Not one responded. We sent it again. Not one responded. It was written up in the Washington Post. Not one responded. Why? Because that's the reason. Not just the campaign contribution. That's the reason that they haven't passed airline passenger rights in years. Now, this is not one of the most serious problems in the world. But it illustrates the total arrogance of this Congress collectively. I always say to people when they say, what can we do? I say, it starts with Congress. That's your tool. The smallest, most powerful branch of government. The branch that can be a trim tab for the executive and judiciary. That's the way the framers set it up. The other two branches do not have the appropriation power. They don't have their tax power. They don't have the confirmation power. They don't have the investigative power that Congress can have in terms of quickly and openly, to mention some of its leverage. And there are 535 of them. We can know their names. Why aren't we controlling them? What would it take to control them? History shows some of the things we've done and some of the things you've done in the audience. Tell me any major change in justice in the United States of America apart from the Civil War. Any major change, women's suffrage, abolition of slavery, farmer, populist, progressive reform, labor unions, Medicare, Social Security, you name it, that ever took more than 1% of active citizens involved mobilizing for the reform. Sometimes 300 people, as long as they have public opinion behind them. If they have public opinion behind them, and they're organized in congressional districts, and now they can weave together much more insistently with the internet, the press, reluctant as it is to cover the civil community and the civil society, will cover what they do because they're getting signals of real power out there. They will cover power. But it's not happening. And why isn't it happening? Well, if you take the population at large and you start deleting millions of people who are not able to link together Congress watchdog clubs 300 to 500 hours a year, open up a couple offices full-time in each congressional district, you'll have a lot of millions of people who just can't do that because of they're ill, they're obligated, family, terribly impoverished, etc. Millions of people. But you don't need more than 1%. And the nice thing about that 1% is that on major transformational changes in this country, you have liberal-conservative convergence. On living wages, never mind what the think tanks are trying to divide and rule. Never mind the ruling groups who for 2,000 years have developed a strategy of divide and rule. And it's amazing how people fall for it. And there are things that are divisive, obviously, without having to be sandpapered. There's reproductive rights, there's immigration now, there's prayer in schools, the usual traditional ones. But look at living wage, look at full health care, look at cracking down on corporate abuse and corporate crime and corporate monopoly. Look at a decent, fair tax system. Look at the accountability desires of people in positions in power. Comes in 70, 80, 90%, even without an organized move to advance it in the media. Breaking up the big banks comes in at 90%. They know what's going to happen next. Another crash and another bailout, and it won't be just the big banks crashing. So you have this convergence where people live, work, and raise their family. The ideological schisms are nowhere near as prominent as we see them on Fox News or NPR, because empirically they have to respond to reality. They want health care. They want clean air. They want clean water. They want decent streets. They want public services. They want fair play, regardless of whether they're red state or blue state or conservative or liberal. It's the citizen movement that overcomes the divide and rule tactics and strategies. But to do that, we've got to move from sociology to psychology, because psychology makes us ask important questions of ourselves. Do we know what we would like to have done in this country and world of ours? This temporary stay we're given? I'm sure we do. There's a fundamental strain of fair play in the vast majority of people all over the world. Do we have the time to do anything about it? We make time. Do we have knowledge of other people who share our views that we can connect with arm in arm? Yeah, once we get over the small talk and the text messaging, do we have the self-respect to put all these in motion? That's what it's all about. Self-respect about the plight of humanity and the natural world and posterity. Self-respect that breaks up our daily routine, tyrannical as it is for all of us. Self-respect to show up and stand tall. How many of you have begged your friends who agree with you just to come to a meeting, come to a march, come to a demonstration, come to a city council? Don't have time, have other commitments. If you don't have time for democracy, we don't have time for ourselves in a most fundamental sense. How easily we escape from facing ourselves in the mirror. And suddenly our culture has become one where you're not supposed to harangue your fellow citizen. Why are you a scold, Ralph? Why do you scold people? Because I hear from people about their grievances, about the loss of their loved ones to preventable practices. There's nothing special about me. You say, oh, you can do it, Ralph. You can do it, Joan. You can do it, Bert. You can do it, David. You're special. There's nothing special about us except the thirst for justice as the reason for being. That's what's special about us. We want to project our conscience, something that's not denied anybody in our country. It's available. It's free. There's no ticket to admission to engage in a vibrant, productive democracy.
You're listening to Ralph Nader on Land of the Lawless. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
We published in the 70s the best-selling book on Congress ever written. It was on the Donahue Show. It was all over. And came out in paperback, several editions. I went to a publisher a couple of years ago, and I said, how about an update? This is a major publisher. He said, are you kidding? Nobody will buy a book on Congress. I said, what's happened? He said, it's information overload. You know, they can get anything on the internet. Or they're just not interested. That's our survey data. I went to other publishers, not interested. Now, there are books written on Congress, but a lot of them are a little biographical. Some of them are narrow. Some of them are technical. But this should be a raging bestseller. People aren't interested. I always believe that if something is important, it can be made interesting. That's what the best journalists do. That's what the best writers do. That's what the best speakers do. It is so bad now, you can't reach people in Congress. You can't reach their staff. They have voicemail, often hours at a time, during daytime business. Rand Paul locks his office in a heavily guarded Senate office building. You have to do the cell phone to get into a senator's office suite. They don't have public hearings on the tax law. They wanted to smash the tort system. They had no public hearings. They got five bills through the House of Representatives. They have no public hearings on major issues. This is unheard of. Unheard of degradation. When you call, the people look and see whether you're a campaign contributor so you can get through to an intern. How are we going to stand for this? They're using our power and turning it against us. Our delegated sovereign power and turning it against us. So I hope that you'll go out and start conversation in a very fundamental look in the mirror way. Everything starts with a conversation. Every justice movement starts with a conversation between two people, four, ten. We've shown that in our own history. I had a little book that we had a signing here called Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. I give all kinds of examples, not just 10 years ago, 20 years ago, throughout our history, less than 1%. Isn't that an optimistic recognition of historical experience to know that it takes so few good people representing majority opinion? Anybody here from EPIC? There's a little group down on Connecticut Avenue. That's the main bulwark to try to salvage what privacy's left in an internet age. I went there a few months ago. They're just like 8 or 9, 10 people. And they're shaking the foundations. And you'll hear more from them with their litigation and their petitions and their reports and they're reading the fine print of Google and Facebook. It's easier than we think. That is the best conversation starter. When you talk to people who don't think anything can be done, que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. Just say, don't you know it's easier than you think? And you get it moving. So thank you very much.
You brought out the fact that the psychology is important in this thing. Well, you know your friend Freud learned that he couldn't do psychology unless he used Socratic method to get people's ideas out first. Okay, you know from law school, that's how law school is taught. Okay, so you have masses and you want them to work together. But how do you listen to them first and integrate their ideas? And that's a very difficult task. How would you do that? You can't just say, hey, I have this great idea. People all have their own view of what has to be done.
That's why you go down what semanticists say, the abstraction ladder. People are manipulated and enraged against one another with use of abstractions, images, ratio, whatever. You go down to where they live, work, and raise their families. I mean, I've been in the Deep South and gotten standing ovations for saying the same thing I say in Massachusetts. Why? Well, because, you know, conservatives don't go working for Walmart and say, I'm a conservative. I don't want a minimum wage that gives me the wherewithal to support my family, right? So you can see where this conservative worker may vote for Trump, but it dissipates. So that's one way you communicate. Another way you communicate is the high points of our own history, the best practices. You go down south, you know, the populist progressive movement started in East Texas. A couple hundred counties, they signed up hundreds of farmers door-to-door and a dollar dues, which is like $50 today, and then swept across the country. So you're in Indiana, you talk about Eugene Debs, see? So best practices is another way. A third is care for your children and grandchildren. That is, you may not care about yourself, but what about your children and your grandchildren? Margaret Mead said that was one way to get parents to wear seatbelts and get their kids to wear seatbelts. Because that projection forward brings out the best in them if they've given up, you know, on themselves in various ways. I'll tell you, even though I say it's easier than we think, and it is, the depth of surrender in this country is totally staggering. And part of it is because people are kept so busy with anxiety, fear, dread, two low-paid jobs, $1,000 a month daycare, huge commutes, having to take care of ailing parents and grandparents. I mean, you say, who has time, right? But you go into New England, where you have the town meeting form of government, and you have small towns, and there is no barrier whatsoever for you to be part of the local legislature, because that's what a town meeting is, if it doesn't go to referendum, right? So there's no transportation problem. There's no voter suppression problem, right? There's nothing. And they're dying because people don't show up. So there you are, the probably classic democratic institution in the world, handed to people, and they can't be bothered to walk four or five blocks or across the street to the local school auditorium to participate. Well, naturally, the ones that do are often the shouters, and the shouters can be very abusive. Just five, six of them can jam up a town's town meeting, and that turns away the others. Well, they're looking for excuses. What do you mean turns away the others? The four excuses we get for people not being active citizens: they don't have the time. They don't have the knowledge. Even if they had the time and the knowledge, they don't want to be slandered in public and abused. And even if they had the time and knowledge and they had asbestos skin, it won't matter because the big boys will decide whatever they decide. So there you are, the escape rationale. It's total nonsense. You talk to them. You think your taxes are being used right? No. You think the damn potholes are being? No. Do you think the lake is polluted? Yes. Do you think the politicians aren't listening to you? They're not listening. Well, what do you mean you don't have the time? You think your property taxes are discriminatory? Do you think that they're not cracking down on the health insurance industry? Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So it does take, every neighborhood has influential people who are civically active. Right. That's the core touch. That's where you want to get to, because they already are believable and they're known. So you're not seen as an outsider. If we had 1,000 full-time lecturers in this country to get full Medicare for all, single payer, whatever, free choice of doctor, much more efficient, on and on. If they spoke to 1,000 people a week, well advanced, you know, clubs, gatherings, small groups here and there. But let's say 1,000 fan out around the country, and they have good conversations with a total of 1,000 people each a week. That's 1 million people a week. That's 50 million people a year. What mega billionaire couldn't fund that who's enlightened? You see, we never think of that, right? Oh, God, how do you reach people? people in small groups, small communities. They're always gathering in every town for all kinds of ways.
First, I should say, when I started law school in 1969, my paper that you had to write for legal writing was based on your stuff.
Did you flunk?
No, I did quite well. What can we do about the Supreme Court? I mean, the court that we studied back in the day was the Warren Court, and it looked like we were just going to keep making progress, and things turned around abruptly, and it's gone right ever since, and now we're back to Lochner.
Well, first of all, any of you read this book, Democracy in Chains, by McLean, professor at Duke? It outlines how much more energy and savvy the corporate right wing has than our side. It's just unbelievable. They just decided that they're going to take over the three branches of government. And they did it with, a so-called brain trust like James Buchanan at George Mason and others. They did it with these think tanks.
Yep.
And they did it with money. And they did it tactically to advance gerrymandering by switching like 500 state legislative seats in various states to get the gerrymandering thing in 2010.
Yep.
And she outlines it all. She actually got into the archives.
Mm-hmm. The Heritage Foundation, the Federalist
and
Society,
all of that. All right, well, where's our side, right? I mean, for every Koch brother, you have George Soros. For every think tank, where's our side? We have the polls. Our issues have the polls on our side. And they perpetrated a not-so-silent coup d'etat. The Supreme Court, that was due to the Democrats winning elections and losing the Electoral College. So why aren't they trying to abolish the Electoral College? It's already on the way to being abolished by a citizen group. Do you know about national vote power, is it called? It's just seven people hired by Steve Silberstein, who's a retired computer executive. In San Francisco, he's already gotten enough state legislatures to reach 172 electoral votes. You go to 270 and it's over. Basically, California, New York, and others have passed laws saying if enough states pass laws that represent 270 votes, we'll give our electoral college vote to whoever wins the national vote. So that whoever wins the national vote wins the electoral college vote.
But those are lifetime appointments. And the people they choose are young.
Yes. So how do you change it? Well, this is going to take pretty dramatic provocation, which seems to be on its way, to develop an impeachment process so that it isn't a big deal. See, I think judges that systemically subvert the sovereign power of the people to the domination of corporate power. See, they're basically supporting an artificial entity here again and again. Over real people. And it's going to get worse with artificial intelligence and the internet and so on. That is, to me, a grounds for impeachment. Because what they're doing basically is subverting the rights of real human beings to the supremacy of commercial corporations. In all ways, civil rights, civil liberties, on and on and on. I mean, they're seizing the civil rights that were used for real people, and the 14th Amendment, all that. Now, if that becomes a persistent pattern, and it affects health, safety, war, peace, civil rights, civil liberties. We have got to seriously take this case to the Congress. Some people said 15-year terms. You know, I mean, there are long-range differences here. But, you know, it does come down to who wins the Electoral College, which is really, I always, when I write Donald Trump, I refer to him as our selected president. He doesn't like that. You see, he didn't win the popular vote. Kerry almost did it in reverse. If 60,000 votes shifted in Iowa, he would have won the Electoral College, even though George W. Bush won the popular vote in 2004. So that's why they're not interested, because, you know, they're in Ohio. That's why they're not interested, because, you know, it's sort of like a roulette game here. You know, it can favor you one way or the other. And this has happened five times in American history, where the candidate who got the second votes, most number of votes, won the presidency. We're in a country. We're in the world. Something like this happened. And it is not a high profile issue. Yes.
What, if anything, have you changed your mind about?
Are you sure you want to say if anything?
Huh? Yeah. What
garlic.
If, what if anything? If garlic. That was the answer I was expecting.
Do you want to be a little more specific?
I want to know if you've changed your mind on anything politically related in your life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Believe it or not, I started out as a libertarian. I didn't like government regulation. And then I faced reality as I connected with more and more problems at grassroots America.
Can I just ask, about how old were you when you say you changed from libertarian to...
It was a gradual process in the early 20s. I didn't like public housing. It disadvantaged landlords unfairly, taxpayer. And then I saw the slums, and I saw what landlords did. Changed my mind.
What I'd like to know is, how does the Trump administration compare to the previous administrations that you have lived through? What kind of impact has it made on your mind?
Well, it's obviously the worst, except for they haven't gotten us into a big war yet. But they have systemically not enforced statutory requirements in the consumer, labor, and environment and other areas. Now, you would think there'd be a remedy for that. This isn't prosecutorial discretion, where you got a lot of polluters and you don't have enough prosecutors, so you pick some worse polluters and the others, you're not enforcing the law. This is Mulvaney and all these guys brazenly saying they're shutting down the enforcement arm. They're taking the federal cop off the corporate crime beat. And there is no ready remedy for us as citizens other than using the Administrative Procedures Act, which is prolonged and it just affects the agency, to petition directly and get them out of office, to say, you took an oath of office to enforce the laws of this agency. You said so to Congress under oath in your confirmation process. You're doing exactly the opposite, systematically, brazenly, openly, defiantly. You should be expelled from your job. And there's no ready remedy for that in terms of a private citizen action.
You must have cried when the Consumer Protection Agency was... dismantled under Mulvaney.
Well, yeah, I don't cry, I bellow. But I mean, it is true. I mean, Mulvaney came over part time from the Office of Management and Budget. He's the worst of the worst, by the way. A lawyer from South Carolina who was a member of Congress, hated deficits and cut the IRS budget to the bone so they couldn't collect any of $400 billion. And there's no probity there. And he basically said, we're going to shut it down. One of the functions is the promotion of Wall Street. Promotion of Wall Street was established to bring Wall Street to bay, to prosecute the Wall Street crimes. That's how brazen they are, right? Now, do you think they'd get away with this if we really had an opposing party worthy of the name? Going back, Senator Robert Taft would demand investigative hearings, Mr. Conservative, in the 1950s. The Democrats don't have the energy. The Tea Party people in the Congress, I've often said, give me four of these guys, and they'll roll the entire progressive caucus.
It's because they have donors, too.
Yeah, they have their own sinecures. I was just told by a high official, the AFL-CIO, it's good I was sitting down. I was on the phone, and I said, how can they not do this, and how can they not do that? There are millions, 125 million non-voters, 125 million. All they need is 10 million of them to move from non-voters to voters. And that's a matter of 10 weeks knocking on doors, neighborhood meetings, and so on. How could they not do this? And they could landslide the Republicans. He lowers his voice. This guy's a total loyalist. He said, Ralph, they don't really want to win. I said, what? He said, they want to win their own seats, but they don't want to really win the election over the Republicans and take power. I mean, this is a guy that goes to all kinds of meetings. I mean, there is this idea that they think there's catastrophe ahead and they don't want to be held responsible for it. And when you see how they contend, I listen to the radio C-SPAN debates of members of Congress running against each other over the years. It takes me sometimes 15 minutes to figure out who's a Republican, who's a Democrat. How many of you know Lapham's Quarterly? That's a great journal. I just wrote an article for him, which I passed out to all the first-year law students at Harvard. Put it right on their desk. And it's called Land of the Lawless. Lawlessness is the norm in our country for the rich and powerful. It is the norm. And the law schools refuse to recognize that. That corporations are violating the law. And if they get caught 1% of the time, it's too much for them. Whether it's pollution laws or consumer laws or payday loan rackets or landlord building codes, or they do it generically by rigging private contracts, fine print, or by keeping you from conflict resolution, or by getting the government to regulate us instead of them under the guise of deregulation, which is a way of shifting the government regulatory party to the corporate regulatory party. So anyway, if you want to get it, it's at hlrecord.org. This is the most comprehensive, concise documentation of arguably one of the biggest issues confronting us ever, which is the destruction of the rule of law when it comes to the powerful. And Harvard Law Record is hlrecord.org. They reprinted it. And so how many people you think polled want rigorous enforcement of regulatory laws? Between 85 and 90% of the people. Again and again. But the Democrat Party does not represent that opinion, you see. This business of left, right, conservative, red, this is just manipulation. Apart from, you know, maybe a half a dozen, really, like reproductive rights. You see? It's manipulation and very effective manipulation. Why are we fooled and flummox so easily? When I was campaigning, I would say to people, have you ever seen a politician who doesn't flatter the people? And they sort of laugh. And I said, well, tell me, if you have, I'll show you a visiting Martian. It's manipulation. Fooled, flummoxed, flattered. They're very good at it. And we've got to cut right through there. Luckily, I had a lucky choice of parents, because when my father would receive politicians in a restaurant, they had a long counter, and the politician would come and say, hi, I'm so-and-so running for, hi, I'm so-and-so, hi, I'm so-and-so, hi. And my father would be at the coffee urn, and he'd be the last hand shook. And my father wouldn't let him go. And, you know, he'd say, hi, Mr. I want to talk with you. I don't want to just shake your hand. Come on, sit down, have a cup of coffee, see what you stand for. We're so easily flattered. Reagan was a fantastic flatterer. So
he's a great communicator.
Yeah, well, what does he communicate? You know, we have to beware of cruel men with smiles. By the way, the best gift you can give a youngster today is a book, an actual print book. And you can show them how to open it, okay? And show that you're respecting their intelligence by giving them a print book.
You were just listening to Ralph Nader on Land of the Lawless. He spoke at Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. Founder of Public Citizen, he's a longtime advocate for consumer safety and workers' rights. He's the author of numerous books, including Breaking Through Power, To the Ramparts, and How the Rats Reformed Congress. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Robin Kelly, Arjun Singh Sethi, Barbara Ehrenreich, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. And we have more than 20 programs with Ralph Nader. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.